sleep by means of baths, and to be surrounded every day by crowds of flatterers. The other delights in dirt and filth, in the solitude of the inaccessible desert, and dreads the approach of all mortal men. The one lives on the esteem and applause of men, the other glories in injuries offered to it, and in persecutions. Chapter 12. What is our free will, which stands in between the lust of the flesh and the spirit? Between these two desires, then, the free will of the soul stands in an intermediate position, somewhat worthy of blame, and neither delights in the excesses of sin nor acquiesces in the sorrows of virtue. Seeking to restrain itself from carnal passions in such a way as not nevertheless to be willing to undergo the requisite suffering, and wanting to secure bodily chastity without chastising the flesh, and to acquire purity of heart without the exertion of vigils, and to abound in spiritual virtues together with carnal ease, and to attain the grace of patience without the irritation of contradiction, and to practice the humility of Christ without the loss of worldly honor, to aim at the simplicity of religion in conjunction with worldly ambition, to serve Christ not without the praise and favor of men, to profess the strictness which truth demands without giving the slightest offense to anybody. In a word, it is anxious to pursue future blessings in such a way as not to lose present ones. And this free will would never lead us to attain true perfection, but would plunge us into a most miserable condition of lukewarmness, and make us like those who are rebuked by the Lord's remonstrance in the Apocalypse. I know thy works, that thou art neither hot nor cold. I would that thou wert hot or cold. But now thou art lukewarm, and I will forthwith spew thee out of my mouth. 2:21. Were it not that these contentions which rise up on both sides disturb and destroy this condition of lukewarmness? For when we give in to this free will of ours and want to let ourselves go in the direction of this slackness, at once the desires of the flesh start up and injure us with their sinful passions, and do not suffer us to continue in that state of purity in which we delight, and allure us to that cold and thorny path of pleasure which we have to dread. Again, if inflamed with fervor of spirit, we want to root out the works of the flesh, and without any regard to human weakness, try to raise ourselves altogether to excessive efforts after virtue. The frailty of the flesh comes in, and recalls us, and restrains us from that over excess of spirit which is bad for us. And so the result is that as these two desires are contradicting each other in a struggle of this kind, the soul's free will, which does not like either to give itself up entirely to carnal desires, nor to throw itself into the exertions which virtue calls for, is tempered, as it were, by a fair balance, while this struggle between the two hinders that more dangerous free will of the soul, and makes a sort of equitable balance in the scales of our body, which marks out the limits of flesh and spirit most accurately, and does not allow the mind inflamed with fervor of spirit to sway to the right hand, nor the flesh to incline through the pricks of sin to the left. And while this struggle goes on day after day in us to our profit, we are driven most beneficially to come to that fourth stage which we do not like, so as to gain purity of heart, not by ease and carelessness, but by constant efforts and contrition of spirit, to retain our chastity of the flesh by prolonged fastings, hunger, thirst, and watchfulness, to acquire purpose of heart by reading, vigils, constant prayer, and the wretchedness of solitude, to preserve patience by the endurance of tribulation, to serve our Maker in the midst of blasphemies and abounding insults, to follow after truth, if need be, amid the hatred of the world and its enmity, and while, with such a struggle going on in our body, we are secured from slothful carelessness and incited to that effort which is against the gain and to the desire for virtue, our proper balance is admirably secured. And on one side, the languid choice of our free will is tempered by fervor of spirit, and on the other, the frigid coldness of the flesh is moderated by a gentle warmth. And while the desire of the spirit does not allow the mind to be dragged into unbridled license, neither does the weakness of the flesh allow the spirit to be drawn on to unreasonable aspirations after holiness. lest in the one case incentives to all kinds of sins might arise, or in the other, the earliest of all sins might lift its head and wound us with a yet more fatal dart of pride. But a due equilibrium will result from this struggle, and open to us a safe and secure path of virtue between the two, and teach the soldier of Christ ever to walk on the King's highway. And thus the result will be that when, in consequence of the lukewarmness arising from this sluggish will of which we have spoken, the mind has been more easily entangled in carnal desires, it is checked by the desire of the Spirit, which by no means acquiesces in earthly sins. And again, if through overmuch feeling our spirit has been carried in unbounded fervor and towards ill-considered and impossible heights, it is recalled by the weakness of the flesh to sounder considerations, and rising above the lukewarm condition of our free will with due proportion and even course proceeds along the way of perfection. Something of this sort we hear that the Lord ordained in the case of the building of that tower in the book of Genesis, where a confusion of tongues suddenly sprang up and put a stop to the blasphemous and wicked attempts of men. For there would have remained there in opposition to God, aye, and against the interest of those who had begun to assail His divine majesty, an agreement boding no good, unless by God's providence the difference of languages, raising disturbances among them, had forced them because of the variations of their words to go on to a better condition, and a happy and valuable discord had recalled to salvation those whom a ruinous union had driven to destruction. As when divisions arose, they began to experience human weakness, of which, when puffed up by their wicked plots, they had hitherto known nothing. Chapter 13. Of the advantage of the delay which results from the struggle between flesh and spirit. But from the differences which this conflict causes, there arises a delay that is so far advantageous to us, and from this struggle an adjournment that is for our good, so that while through the resistance of the material body we are hindered from carrying out those things which we have wickedly conceived with our minds, we are sometimes recalled to a better mind either by penitence springing up or by some better thoughts which usually come to us when delay in carrying out things and time for reflection intervene. Lastly, those who, as we know, are not prevented from carrying out the desires of their free will by any hindrances of the flesh, I mean devils and spiritual wickedness, these, since they have fallen from a higher and angelical state, we see are in a worse plight than men, inasmuch as, owing to the fact that opportunity is always present to gratify their desires, they are not delayed from irrevocably performing whatever evil they have imagined, because as their mind is quick to conceive it, so their substance is ready and free to carry it out. And while a short and easy method is given them for doing what they wish, no salutary second thoughts come in to amend their wicked intention. Chapter 14. Of the Incurable Depravity of Spiritual Wickednesses. For a spiritual substance and one that is not tied to any material flesh has no excuse for an evil thought which arises within, and also shuts out forgiveness for its sin, because it is not harassed as we are by incentives of the flesh without to sin, but is simply inflamed by the fault of a perverse will. And therefore its sin is without forgiveness and its weakness without remedy. For as it falls through the allurements of no earthly matter, so it can find no pardon or place for repentance. And from this we can clearly gather that this struggle which arises in us of the flesh and spirit against each other is not merely harmless, but actually extremely useful to us. Chapter 15. Of the value of the lust of the flesh against the spirit in our case. To begin with, because it is an immediate reproof of our sloth and carelessness, and like some energetic schoolmaster who never allows us to deviate from the line of strict discipline. And if our carelessness has ever so little exceeded the limits of due gravity which become it, it immediately excites us by the stimulus of desire, and chides us and recalls us to due moderation. Secondly, because in the matter of chastity and perfect purity, when by God's grace we see that we have been for some time kept from carnal pollution, in order that we may not imagine that we can no longer be disturbed by the motions of the flesh, and thereby be elated and puffed up in our secret hearts, as if we no longer bore about the corruption of the flesh. It humbles and checks us, and reminds us by its pricks that we are but men. 2:22. For as we ordinarily fall without much thought into other kinds of sins, and those worse and more harmful, and are not so easily ashamed of committing them, so in this particular one the conscience is especially humbled. And by means of this illusion it is stung by the recollection of passions that have been neglected, as it sees clearly that it is rendered unclean by natural emotions, of which it knew nothing while it was still more unclean through spiritual sins. And so, coming back at once to the cure of its former sluggishness, it is warned both that it ought not to trust in the attainments of purity in the past, which it sees to be lost by ever so small a falling away from the Lord, and also that it cannot attain the gift of this purity except by God's grace alone, since actual experience somehow or other teaches us that if we are anxious to reach abiding perfection of heart, we must constantly endeavor to obtain the virtue of humility. Chapter 16. Of the excitements of the flesh, without the humiliation of which we should fall more grievously. To the fact, then, that the pride which results from this purity would be more dangerous than all sins and wickedness, and that we should on that account gain no reward for any height of perfect chastity, we may call as witnesses those powers of which we spoke before, which, since it is believed that they experienced no such fleshly lusts, were cast down from their high and heavenly estate in everlasting destruction simply from pride of heart. And so we should be altogether hopelessly lukewarm, since we should have no warning of carelessness on our part implanted either in our body or in our mind. Nor should we ever strive to reach the glow of perfection, or even keep to strict frugality and abstinence, were it not that this excitement of the flesh springs up and humbles us and baffles us and makes us keen and anxious about purifying ourselves from spiritual sins. Chapter 17. Of the lukewarmness of eunuchs. Lastly, on this account, in those who are eunuchs, we often detect the existence of this lukewarmness of mind, because, as they are, so to speak, free from the needs of the flesh, they fancy that they have no need either of the trouble of bodily abstinence or of contrition of heart. And being rendered slack by this freedom from anxiety, they make no efforts either truly to seek or to acquire perfection of heart or even purity from spiritual faults. And this condition, which is the result of their state in the flesh, becomes natural, which is altogether a worse state. For he who passes from the state of coldness to that of lukewarmness is branded by the Lord's words as still more hateful. Chapter 18. The question, what is the difference between the carnal and natural man? Germanus. You have, it seems to us, very clearly shown the value of the struggle which is raised between the flesh and spirit, so that we can believe that it can in a sort of way be grasped by us, and therefore we want to have this also explained to us in the same way, viz., what is the difference between the carnal and the natural man, or how the natural man can be worse than the carnal? Chapter 19. The answer concerning the threefold conditions of souls. Daniel. There are, according to the statements of Scripture, three kinds of souls. The first is the carnal, the second the natural, and the third the spiritual, which we find are thus described by the Apostle. For of the carnal he says, I gave you milk to drink, not meat, for you were not able as yet. But neither indeed are you now able, for you are yet carnal. And again, for whereas there is among you envying and contention, are you not carnal? 2:23. Concerning the natural, he also speaks as follows. But the natural man perceiveth not the things that are of the Spirit of God, for it is foolishness to him. But concerning the spiritual, but the spiritual man judgeth all things, and he himself is judged by no man. 2:24. And again, you who are spiritual instruct such ones in the spirit of meekness. 2:25. And so, though at our renunciation we cease to be carnal, i.e., We began to separate ourselves from intercourse with those in the world, and to have nothing to do with open pollution of the flesh. We must still be careful to strive with all our might to attain forthwith a spiritual condition, lest haply we flatter ourselves because we seem, as far as the outer man is concerned, to have renounced this world and got rid of the defilement of carnal fornication, as if by this we had reached the heights of perfection, and thence become careless and indifferent about purifying ourselves from other affections, and so, being kept back between these two, become unable to reach the stage of spiritual advancement, either because we think that it is ample sufficient for our perfection if we seem to separate ourselves as regards the outward man from intercourse with this world and from its pleasure, or because we are free from corruption and carnal intercourse. And thus we find ourselves in that lukewarm condition which is considered the worst of all, and discover that we are spewed out of the mouth of the Lord in accordance with these words of His: I would that thou wert hot or cold, but now thou art lukewarm, and I will begin to spew thee out of my mouth. 2:26. And not without good reason does the Lord declare that those whom He has previously received in the bowels of His love, and who have become shamefully lukewarm, shall be spewed out and rejected from His bosom. Inasmuch as, though they might have yielded Him some health-giving sustenance, they preferred to be torn away from His heart, thus becoming far worse than those who had never found their way into the Lord's mouth as food, just as we turn away with loathing from that which nausea compels us to bring up. For whatever is cold is warmed when received into the mouth, and is received with satisfaction and good results. But whatever has been once rejected owing to its miserable lukewarmness, we cannot, I will not say touch with the lips, but even look on from a distance without the greatest disgust. Rightly then is he said to be worse, because the carnal man, i.e., the worldly man and the heathen, is more readily brought to saving conversion and to the heights of perfection than one who has been professed as a monk, but has not, as his rule directs, laid hold on the way of perfection, and so has once for all drawn back from that fire of spiritual fervor. For the former is at last broken down by the sins of the flesh, and acknowledges his uncleanness, and in his compunction hastens from carnal pollution to the fountain of true cleansing and the heights of perfection. And in his horror at that cold state of infidelity in which he finds himself, he is kindled with the fire of the Spirit and flies the more readily to perfection. For one who has, as we said, once started with a lukewarm beginning and has begun to abuse the name of monk, and who has not laid hold on the way of this profession with the humility and fervor that he ought, when once he is infected by this miserable plague, and as it were unstrung by it, can no longer of himself discern what is perfect, nor learn from the admonitions of another. For he says in his heart that which the Lord tells us, because I am rich and wealthy and want nothing. And so this which follows is at once applied to him: but thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. 2:27. And he is so far in a worse condition than a worldly man, because he has no idea that he is wretched or blind or naked or requires cleansing or needs to be directed and taught by anyone. And on this account he receives no sound advice, as he does not realize that he is weighed with the name of monk and is lowered in the judgment of all. Whereas, though everybody believes him to be a saint and regards him as a servant of God, he must hereafter be subjected to a stricter judgment and punishment. Lastly, why should we any longer linger over those things which we have sufficiently discovered and proved by experience? We have often seen those who were cold and carnal, i.e., worldly men and heathen, attain spiritual warmth, but lukewarm and natural men never. And these two, we read in the prophet, are hated of the Lord, so that a charge is given to spiritual and learned men to desist from warning and teaching them, and not to so